It is Saturday, July 21st, 2011. We are broadcasting live from Santa Cruz, California on the Central Coast. This is KUSP. Today on GeekSpeak Geek News, the bandwidth for GeekSpeak.org is provided by GNI. And it's time now, of course, for GeekSpeak. Welcome to GeekSpeak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today's theme song is by Michael Newman of PetStarMusic.com. Michael, thank you so much for making the song. If you'd like to make a song for GeekSpeak, please feel free to email us one. We'd love to have variety here on GeekSpeak. In the second half of the show, we'll invite you to join the conversation about technology. You can ask us anything you'd like. The phone number, 1-800-655-5877. I'll give out that contact information again when I invite your participation in about half an hour. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Miles Elam. He's a software engineer and political junkie. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning.
We also have Mr. Ben Jaffe, a freelance media guy and Stanford instructor.
Ahoy, hoy.
Ooh, what language?
That was Monty Burns-ish, I think, right?
I like that.
No, I need to ask my brother. He would know.
Now, last week, we promised not to talk about Facebook or Google Plus. So you knew it was going to happen. This week, we'd talk about one of those. But this week, what are we not going to talk about, Ben?
We're not going to be talking about Lion because none of us have used it.
All right.
It came out a couple days ago, and we'll put a link to a very detailed review on the GeekSpeak website.
Great. So Google Plus, I think. Would you agree?
Sure. We'll talk about Google Plus and the fact that people are going to it in droves. Google Plus has seen 20 million new users in just a few weeks.
It's only been around for a few weeks. 20 million users.
20 plus, yeah.
So Google Plus, a social networking kind of thing run by Google, kind of like Facebook, kind of like Twitter, kind of like a blogging system. It's the best description we've got. And that uptake seems to be really fast.
Yes. In fact, it is much faster than any other service that's ever been released. Twitter saw, 20 million users like in a big jolt, but that was over a few months.
Right.
It was over a few weeks. And this is with Google Plus being invite only, not even making it available to everyone to go on as soon as they want to.
Right. All right. Are you using it, Miles? I know you've got an account. We're connected, but I haven't seen you post anything.
I haven't posted anything on Google Plus. I actually had just been busy with other things. Haven't taken a look at it. I really like the interface, so I've been like putting people in different circles. Go like, yeah. So when I actually post something, I'm going to have these circles available. And I haven't posted anything.
A few weeks ago, when it first came on, we all got invites relatively quickly, and I suggest people to email us. I think we've got about 60 people email us requesting accounts.
It was crazy.
We've invited them all, and it's been fun to see people added in.
Yeah, I created a Google fan circle.
Yeah,
as did I.
Do you want
you can
to
have,
Don,
and
grab a
Don
seat.
Has some questions about all Google right. Plus. So.
Yeah, come on, Don's still here. Hi.
Okay, I just want to know, I have some people who belong in several circles. Can I do that?
You can. You can.
Overlapping circles?
Definitely.
That sounds a little risque.
I'll put you in awesomeness and also famous. Yeah.
Venn circles. It's like a really intense Venn diagram. It's like a really intense Venn diagram.
Yeah, I have people, like my circles are things like people I went to high school with, people I went to UCSC with, people that I do GeekSpeak with, people that are GeekSpeak fans, people that I've been former coworkers with, people that I'm current coworkers with.
Also, it should be noted, no one can know who your circles are. So you can totally have a circle called People I Hate, and you can put, I don't know, all the rest of the geeks in there. And no, I'm kidding.
Right. But you do get a notification that someone has added you to their circles.
A circle. Right. That you don't know
so
what circle.
I think we're talking above and beyond what we should probably clarify at the beginning of this. It's
It's very similar to Facebook groups.
Yeah.
Where you say, this is, you know, my Facebook group, and you're trying to get it so that you can post about the current parties without telling your mom and dad.
The interesting thing about what Google's doing with Google Plus is that the security model is much different. So now, the privacy feeling is different. So now if I have a group that's called The Geeks, which I do, something like that, and Miles and Ben, all the people that have been geeks on the show are in that group. If I want to post something about what's happening this weekend on the show or something, I post it just to that group. It looks like the same interface for me, but it's actually kind of a private message to those people. Now, when they reply, they can potentially when they reply, they don't necessarily see each other. So it's not like email in that sense. It's much more like a bulletin board only for certain people.
You know what they did right is they made privacy a feature instead of something that was annoying to do. Like Facebook groups, horrible to use, a pain in the butt. But circles, it's kind of fun. You drag, you know, your friends into the circle and you see a little cool animation and everything. And it's cool.
I used groups in Facebook like that all the time. And mostly because I get requests from people that I'm like, what, who's that? And I realize, that's the person whose last name used to be this in high school. Okay, that's a high school person. So that later when I look at that, you know, Ann, I know, oh, that's the Ann from high school because they're in that group. So I was always using Facebook that way. But you couldn't filter as easily. It wasn't as fun. It's true.
Yeah, not as fun, not as easy. So.
Now, a question I have with regard to their business models. Google historically has always gotten business through ads. That's been their bread and butter. That's probably how this is getting funded, how Google Plus is going to be funded. And that is a departure from the model that Facebook uses, which is, yes, they have ads, but those ads give a whole lot of information about the user. When you say, I like Nabisco, I like Wheat Thins,
right.
You know, something like that. They, as soon as you click on like, they have access to your profile and your friend circle and stuff like that.
Again, Facebook's model of ads, it's very clearly that the advertiser is the customer and the people are the product. Like that idea.
Facebook
is
a marketer's dream.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I wonder what different organizations out there think of Google Plus. Google has more in terms of the e-commerce. They have, you know, things like Google Checkout. They have their fingers in that business already. But it seems to me that they're a more limited data point for marketers than it would be for Facebook.
Yeah, I'd agree. I'm curious. I mean, of course, the highly focused ad capability is something that Google's had for a long time in Gmail, and they do use it to some degree, right? The systems actually filter the email, and if your group is talking about chocolate in your email, you're going to see the ads on the side about chocolate. But the data isn't given to the advertiser about what it is, right? In fact, the ad is actually served by Google directly. So all that the advertiser knows is they got a click from somebody.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know anything about the persons that they have discussions about chocolate in their email. And so
and
from
for
that model,
a better you
could
click
see,
rate, yeah,
right. And from that, really, it's just to hopefully increase the click rate. That's Google's, you know, the reason for that is to make it more targeted, and hopefully that same idea will come across in the Google Plus place when they start to monetize it, which they haven't done yet. Ben, you've got some stories about Google since we keep talking about Google.
Yeah. Just a quick story about Google Plus is that there is actually a Google Plus manual that has been released. But what's really interesting about this is it's not been written by Google. It's been collaboratively written by people who are really interested in Google Plus. So basically, it's a gigantic Google Doc.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people can log in, they can edit things, they can change it. It's like Wikipedia, except it's on a Google Doc.
Yeah, it's funny that it's a Google Doc rather than... And I guess it makes sense that it's a Google Doc, of course, because everyone that's using Google Plus has a Google profile. So therefore, you can use the docs.
Yeah.
But in traditional forms of... collaborative documentation writing, you normally just grab a wiki and do it that way, and instead they're using a Google Doc.
It's fun too.
It's actually harder to edit with thousands of people. But.
It's fun too because, like, whenever there's a heading that says Google, you've got all the different Google colors for each letter and things that if I was writing a document, I would never want to spend the time to do. You always have someone out there who's like, "Hey, what would be cool? It would be cool if we just made all these letters colored." You know,
I think it's neat this idea of collaborative documentation and seeing it like that. It's cool. But
yeah.
I was actually thanks for that update. But I was actually referring to the other stories. Miles was talking about, you know, the social aspect of Google, and Google took a different track the other day on how they might be implementing some of the group features in Google Plus.
Well, Well, I mean, there are a couple news items with regard to that. One is there's a social network called Fridge, or I should say there was. Really, really fan. Have you guys used it?
Mm-hmm.
No. Yeah. I was also using it for myself and just putting some articles together and getting them in one place with some friends. Amazing, awesome network and everything. I don't remember if I talked about it, but they were actually just acquired by Google Plus.
Yeah.
Which is really cool for them.
The Fridge social network is really interesting in the sense that what you do is you define a space and you invite people in that space, and only the people in that space can use it. And it really is like a Facebook, micro Facebook, if you will, right? Mm-hmm. So when you post images, when you post stories, whatever, the only people that are in that group can do it. And as an admin, you're the ones that decide who's in there.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so it has a lot of separation, which is some features that Google Plus has now. But they bought the whole thing lock barrel, and the whole of the group is moving over to Google.
Yeah.
So it means that they're still thinking in that realm, which is interesting.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And then the other big change that Google made is they posted something, a blog post that said "More wood behind fewer arrows." That was the header, and basically it was announcing that they are prioritizing certain products over others, and they're actually going to be closing down Google Labs. So they're not going to be posting new products onto Google Labs onto the website and everything.
To be clear, the labs associated with certain products, like Gmail Labs, is not going to be closed down. It's just the default group labs.
Yeah, if you go to Google Labs, you see all kinds of stuff, like you can browse the human body in 3D and everything, things like that, projects like that that they've developed with big sets of data or whatever, and they're really cool.
I'm curious what this says about the internals of Google, because Google has been a highly research focused corporation. Every employee gets 20% of their time to do whatever project they want to do, with the idea that you give people freedom, creative people freedom, they create neat things. And a lot of the stuff that we see, even Gmail, for example, came out of that kind of research.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but they're not closing down 20% time. That there was no real mention
good.
Of that.
So there
were
no there, modification
there. No. They're just closing down the Labs website, GoogleLabs.com, I think it is.
Mm-hmm.
They're closing that down. And now, not really right now. They're just basically going to find new homes for all of the projects that exist, and they're going to stop going with that model and of everything. And that kind of brings up the question that I found in this article. Is Google becoming more mature but less interesting? Like, I can see it from two perspectives. One is Google's always been this really interesting, innovative company that just, throws money at anything that's cool. They've got cars that drive themselves, for heaven's sake, But at the other, on the other side of it, if they're going to be competing with people like Facebook and people like Apple or companies like Apple, there's this concept of pruning. In a plant, you prune away the dead things and also the things that aren't doing so well in order to give more strength to the things
or you've got
that
two,
you want to focus
you've got
on.
Two buds that are relatively close to each other. Go ahead and clip one so the other one is more flourishes more, even if they're both healthy.
Yeah, so it just depends on your priorities and your ultimate, goals.
And to speak about Google doing interesting things, I remember a story years ago that Miles, you covered, I think, with Google giving cell phones away to homeless people. So the idea that, everyone should be connected, so let's make cell phones available to everybody. Mm-hmm. Which is, like, why? It's not, there's no money in it,
Mm-hmm.
And it's that space that Google seems to play in quite a bit where it's kind of curious. They have this great museum project now. I can't remember what it's called now. Do you know the museum project?
No, but it's on Labs. It is.
But it's also live. It's a live service as well, which is a virtual tour of these amazing museums. We've covered on GeekSpeak before, and I should probably know the URL, but I don't.
But just to finish up the story, did want to say there's also a difference in model with Facebook. Like, for example, the Facebook Connect project. This is when you go to a website, and it has a little button saying Facebook Connect. Allows you to log in with your Facebook account. Allows you to read the comments that you've made on that page, or then when you submit new comments, it goes to your Facebook page, that type of thing. Facebook still ends up as the central repository.
Yeah.
It's a central repository for authentication, central repository for content as well. And Google Plus seems to be going in a different direction. There's this, they can be a central location for
content
authentication,
mm-hmm.
but not necessarily, because they're also allowing for OpenID and OAuth, which is the ability to give out permission to have certain resources. And with that comes the notion that Google is not necessarily the holder of all that information. It's the hub, the tie that binds, so that you have these other sites that have all this content and you can make them available to other people through OAuth, and then Google can see them and aggregate that information, but they're not in control of it. They're merely aggregating a bunch of different sites and growing an ecosystem.
So right now, is that in the development area of Google Plus, what the developer support is getting? Because from what I've seen is that all the content that's being submitted in Google Plus is actually hosted on Google's servers.
That's if you go to Google. But they're also doing things like fostering OAuth and OpenID and Open Social.
Right. They're actually developing in those platforms. So are they doing Open Social in general? Can you give it? Can you give us a definition of Open Social?
Not really.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, one of the problems with Facebook, of course, is this idea that Facebook owns all of the content. So Facebook servers shut off, everything about Facebook goes away, and the idea is that the usefulness of it, the qualities about it that we like, are these abilities to decide who we see and what content we see, which is only right now really possible by kind of giving the ownership to this big company. So instead, the Open Social movement is kind of say, wait a second, we should be able to do this without any kind of ownership. We do email, everybody has their own email servers, and yet we can all send email to each other. So let's start doing social networking in that same kind of way. It's more complicated than that, but I think that's a good definition for now. And I think we should move on with your next story, actually, about tracking people.
Sure. One of the main ways that people try to avoid being tracked is they turn off cookies. I have a lot of friends who will do this. So, like, I just turn off cookies. I don't care.
I like cookies.
I like cookies or too. You got a great cookie video on your YouTube channel, actually.
I do.
Bert and Ernie talking about cookies.
I do.
You do?
I was I just favorited that.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, no, I made that.
You made that.
Oh, yeah. God, I forgot.
So they'll turn off cookies, or they'll leave cookies so that they're only session-based. In other words, as soon as you close your browser, the cookies are gone. There's no persistent storage. Well, there have been a lot of...
I hate to do this, but we got to do the whole description of what a cookie is. I'm a web server like geekspeak.org, and you're a visitor, and you say, hey, Lyle, can I please have this website? And I say, sure, you can have this website. And also, I want to know that you're the one that asked, so can you also hold this piece of information? And every time you ask for something, give that information back to me so I can identify you. That's what a cookie is.
Right.
Moving on.
The technical term for it is saving state. And it is that it's the reason why when you click on from page to page, you will still be logged in to Gmail, for example. Because normally a web page doesn't keep any state. In other words, one click, you go from one page to the next, you lose all information about that user.
Right.
And so you need something that's saved on the browser to be able to tell you that this is the same person as before, just as you mentioned. And there is a possibility for having a cookie stick around for a while, which is the case for if you have Gmail or Yahoo Mail, something like that, and you fire up a browser and you go to Yahoo and you're already logged in, that's a persistent cookie. And that is a very useful point behind cookies. However, they're also used for marketers to be able to track your movements through the web to see, like, what is this person into? What are their browsing habits like? Because that's information that you can monetize. That's, that's, you know, worth money. And so people turn off long-term cookies and just leave session cookies or turn off cookies altogether. And there have been some workarounds for that. People have used Flash as a way to keep cookies around and used other types of JavaScript tricks to keep data around about you, to track you. Well, people have been getting wise to this and locking those down as well and turning off Flash or whatnot. And so now there's the new HTTP redirect header. And this is coming about from a lot of those sites that have shortened URLs, but also the normal pages as well. Well, you'll go to them, and if you have cookies enabled, and that's pretty trivial to figure out if someone has cookies enabled, then it will, if you have
just
cookies enabled, it redirects you back and goes like, yeah, we're already tracking this person, that's fine. If you have cookies disabled, the redirect URL, when you go to Bitly or something like that, some URL shortening tool, and it sends you over to the New York Times or you know, whatever. It will actually put on a query string with an ID. So you'll see at the end a question mark ID equals 137924.
Yes.
And that is a way for them to track you to say, oh, this click went to here, and then it came back over to here.
So what you're saying is that traditionally we've done this with a cookie where you set a cookie, and then later you ask for another page, and at the same time I say, what user is this, and I include an image. And you get tracked that way with cookies. Now, instead, we just pass around an ID in the URL space.
Right. This has been done before with session data.
This has been done before with session data. To describe to people that don't really understand the web.
Right. This has been done before with session data, where it has your user ID up in the URL to for a session ID.
Yeah. I mean, I guess...
But
I guess
now it's being used more for cross
site. We can kind of do this whole thing in a metaphor of driving. So if anyone's gone to the dump, you see sometimes large trucks that go to the dump a lot get a number that sticks on the side of their car. And this actually is an ID of the truck so that the dump knows how much the truck weighs. So you fill up the truck and you go to the dump, and the dump goes, oh, your ID 444. Okay, and they look it up and they go, oh, your truck's a ton. So anything above a ton is going to be garbage. And so then they weigh the truck and you go in, you empty the truck and you leave. If I go to the place and I don't have one of those things, it's a more annoying process. I've got to figure out how much this weight weighs because we haven't done this already. So at the end of that, if I don't have cookies on every time I go to the dump, we've got to do this whole process instead of just having a cookie, identifying it and going, oh, I know what's going on. So that's the cookie process in traditional web development, right?
At the same time,
in this redirect space, it's much more like instead of that, you actually go to different addresses. Every address that you would go to would have a unique identifier. So it wouldn't be just apartment number A. You know, go over here and get this paperwork, apartment number A. You actually say, go to apartment A7417. And it's really just apartment A, but the 7417 is that code.
Right. And the fact that we're making these tortured metaphors
is
the fact that it is complicated for someone who isn't in the business, who isn't using the technology to understand. And that is part of the problem, is how do you get people to try to make things better when they don't even understand the problem set?
Well, the cookie thing is a perfect example. Everybody turns off cookies, and I'm like, it's not a big deal. Like, I've been always been in the space of why, and we all say we like cookies. Cookies are yummy. Why? Why? I mean, that's why they're named that way, really. So people like the idea of getting them. But the truth is, I've never seen that big of a deal about it.
I don't know if that's why they're called cookies.
Actually, I think that's
why. Is that really?
I would assume. Do you think they're called cookies?
I don't know.
You know what assuming does.
Yes.
Yeah.
Moving on. So, so yeah, it is a torture metaphor because it is complicated. But this redirecting thing, there's no way to account for that except to remove all query string information, right?
Actually, it doesn't work in all because it only works with a 301 redirect. You want it to be a temporary redirect, and then
it's
some browsers don't forward that information.
Also, if you then copy that whole URL with the query string, you give it to somebody else, and lots of people go there with that string, it messes up their whole tracking system. So there's problems with it.
But it's even more complex, you see. No, I'm kidding.
Let's talk about something more simple and fun, like music. Ben?
Music. Okay, so music is a pretty interesting topic, and it has been over the years because of the RIAA, which is the most impossible thing to pronounce quickly. RIAA.
RIAA.
RIAA. Yeah, that's easier.
No, sorry.
Thank you, Miles.
Wait, you said it's impossible, and then Miles did it quickly. Brain hurting.
I know. It's okay.
No, Miles is always right.
So you're saying music is interesting because of the RIAA.
You're going to jinx it if you say that. You can't.
That was one episode, dude.
I still maintain you can't see the Great Wall of China from space.
Good point. You can't. Yeah. And you said you could.
And I looked it up. It's on NASA's website. But it's okay. Miles is probably right.
Seems like some bitterness here, Ben. You
want to talk
about
this? Bitter. I'm upset. No. It's okay.
Can I just sum up what you just said, though?
What did I just say?
Music is interesting because the RIAA. I'd like you to clarify this because right now there's this gaping pain in my chest.
So, recording
music is
industry
a form of,
association.
Not
I don't.
That's not why music is interesting. But can you please talk about the story?
Okay.
I'm being pedantic. I'm sorry.
The RIAA has over time been playing hardball with their music, right? They're basically saying you can't get it unless you pay this or you pay that or whatever. Buy our CDs. Okay, that's not working. Okay, well then buy a subscription service or something. And you have all of these various music subscription services. Grooveshark and Pandora is a music streaming service, and Last.fm and Spotify. Now, Spotify has been a really interesting one that I've been following, but it hasn't been in the U.S. for the last, I don't know, year and a half that it's been around or something.
Let's just talk about them real quick. Pandora, you just mentioned, is you give an artist or a name of a song, and then they start kind of making an auto playlist for you.
They make
and
a radio station
and they
for you.
And you basically can vote on all of these things, and you can kind of tune your radio station to what you want.
Exactly. When you say, I don't like this, then they change.
But you don't actually ever hear the song you want specifically.
You're
kind of allowing, you're letting an algorithm decide the music you're going to listen to.
Yeah, exactly.
And they have put advertising in there. You can also get paid service that doesn't have advertising. That's Pandora. Grooveshark is a little different. You can actually specify song titles.
You can specify specific songs. Now, what makes Grooveshark really interesting and unique to me is that they don't I'm not sure exactly the copyright situation with them, but basically users upload albums, and those albums may or may not be allowed to be up there, right? And they'll basically be up on GrooveShark's service until someone comes along and says, hey, I take that down. That's not legally supposed to be there. And then this song that you maybe favorited or something or put a little heart next to disappears, right?
Right.
And it doesn't happen very often, but that's kind of the model that I understand it's based
on. Yeah, okay. So GrooveShark slowly is degrading.
Well, not really, actually. GrooveShark's really flourishing, but the problem that I have with it is that their applications that they put together are not really the most reliable applications. Their mobile application is okay. They've got some UI issues and everything, and then their desktop application runs in a web browser. And although it used to be on Flash or Flex and slow, now it's on HTML5. It's faster, but it's not native. It's not really, really good.
Right, it's inside a browser. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. And Spotify has OS X and Windows applications and mobile applications. And basically the deal with that is they've struck up deals with all of the recording industry companies and everything like that. So it's totally legitimate, legal, everything. You pay, somewhere between $5 and $20 a month, and you get unlimited access to your music on desktop and on mobile.
Not your music.
Sorry, the music.
Any music.
Whatever music you want.
All music.
Pretty much, yeah, like even karaoke stuff is on there. You know, it's pretty amazing.
Now, so you got familiar with this when you were traveling in Europe?
No, I didn't. I guess I could have, but I was too busy traveling to listen to music, okay. You know.
So Spotify just released being available in the U.S.?
Yes, they just released their service in the U.S. just over this last week. And what's... I lost my train of thought. But anyway, they released... their service in the U.S. and they've done it right. I think they've really, really done it right from a user experience perspective right now. Now I qualified that for a particular reason. I'll get into in just a second. Do we have to do the middle break right now or
pretty soon?
Okay, cool. So I'll just wrap this up then. They did a really, really good job with it. I'm extremely impressed with both their free service and their pay service. But here's the issue. If you, one of the biggest advantages is it integrates with your iTunes library, right? So you open up Spotify and it has all the songs that are in your iTunes library plus any other song you want to search for.
All the MP3s files in your
iTunes. Yeah, all of the non-DRM songs. So for most people, almost all the songs. that's kind of cool. You can use it instead of iTunes, right?
Right.
But it's
very similar to iTunes.
It's extremely similar.
They copied iTunes.
Yeah, they pretty much did, except everything's darker colored. All right, great. They just inverted the interface. That's all. And also the red, yellow, and green pips that go across. iTunes turned them vertically, and everyone was annoyed. Well, they have them going the right way, so that's nice. But here's the problem, is that if Spotify later decides to raise the rates... then you, after using the service for a couple months, the pay service, you've probably made playlists with Spotify tracks and with whatever tracks you own. You've stopped buying tracks to have them on your computer, things like that.
The basic way this works is kind of interesting. If you want to listen to a song on Spotify, you download this app, and then you just go find the song. You can find it. You say, I want to add this to a playlist. You make your playlists. And now, whenever you want, you can listen to that song on your mobile, on your computer.
If you pay for that, that's
if you
pay for the service.
You don't actually own it.
You don't actually own it. Yeah. If you don't pay for it, if you do the free version, you can listen to it. It's ad sponsored. You've got visual ads and audio ads.
So then what you're saying that you get trapped.
Yeah, you can get trapped, right? Because later on, if you use this for a year, you've built this music library out of all of these songs that you don't own, your licensing. Maybe a couple of them you own from back the pre-Spotify days. That's kind of a problem. And not only that, what if Spotify decides to try and stick up for you? And the music industry decides, you know what, we're going to raise our rates. And Spotify sticks up for you and says, hey, you know what? No, we care about our users. We're not going to raise our rates. What happens? Those music tracks disappear. Because they're being licensed through those music providers, and history shows that those music providers, the people who actually own the content, are not they're not looking out for the customer's best interest.
Yeah, interesting.
You know?
So, or the artist in many cases.
Or the artist, yeah, anyone.
Artist
really.
Aspect is the thing I'm curious about with Spotify. I'm assuming that music, if they play
yeah,
it,
they get royalties.
Back,
yeah.
They get royalties back.
Yeah, it's just however much.
It depends upon the contract that the artist signed.
Yeah. It's a really interesting thing. We here at KOSP, of course, twice a year we log everything we play for a week, and that information gets concatenated and summed, and that's how the music. That's potentially how the musicians get paid off of the music we play, right? So there's a really complicated process to do that. And it could be simplified with a system like this because potentially Spotify knows exactly how much of every song is played. But, of course, they don't interact with the musicians. They interact with the corporation that owns the rights.
Of course, yeah. But it's always been that way.
Yeah.
So big summary, or short summary rather, Spotify's invite only right now. It's really awesome. They've done it right, but it's not a fix. It's
right.
not... This is the solution. Go with it, you know?
Yeah.
Not that we could endorse it if it was. It just isn't, though.
We're kind of working on getting some invites for Spotify, but right now it's very difficult to do.
Yeah. So we'll see.
You can, of course, submit yourself and potentially get an invite.
Yeah,
we can't control that.
Well, don't do that yet. We'll talk to you guys next week.
No, I mean, they can
them.
Go to Spotify and try to get an account.
Ah, yes.
Yeah. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio KOSP, The Geeks Today.
Today.
I'll do some Australian. Our Miles Elam and Ben Jaffe. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the other room is Rick Philman. He's waiting to take your calls with questions and comments about technology. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. We'll take any kind of call you'd like today. Again, 1-800-655-5877. A web designer walks into a bar but immediately leaves when he sees they are using tables. It's just not his style. Miles, geek bit.
I like that.
This is a historical geek bit. When Germany invaded Denmark in World War II, the Hungarian chemist George de Hevesy dissolved the gold Nobel Prizes of the German physicists Max von Laue and James Franck in aqua regia, also known as nitrohydrochloric acid, to prevent the Nazis from confiscating them. The German government had prohibited Germans from accepting or keeping any Nobel Prize after the jailed peace activist Karl von Ossietzky had received the Nobel Peace Prize in 1935. De Hevesy placed the resulting solution on a shelf in his laboratory in the Niels Bohr Institute. It was subsequently ignored by the Nazis, who thought the jar, one of perhaps hundreds on the shelving, contained common chemicals. After the war, De Hevesy returned to find the solution undisturbed and precipitated the gold out of the acid. The gold was returned to the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences and the Nobel Foundation, who recast the metals and again presented them to Lowe and Frank.
Okay, that's awesome.
Chemistry for the win.
Wow. That's wonderful.
Chemistry defeats Nazis. Nice. Thanks. You had a quick geek bit as well?
Yeah. Kindle Awesomeness, which is, I just received an email from Adobe just last night, and it said, hey, this particular Kindle title that you bought, which I actually got for free, it was one of the out-of-copyright ones, has an update. The version you have has missing content, and we've completed it. If we update your Kindle thing, you're going to lose all of any notes that you put in there. Reply to us if you want to get the updated version and write yes in the first line of your response. So, in other words, Amazon listens to GeekSpeak. They heard us complaining about the 1984 debacle where they like switched out versions. Everyone lost their notes and everyone was upset. That's kind of cool. I'm really happy to see Amazon doing this the right way.
Did you say Amazon sent the note or Adobe? You said Adobe.
Did I say
you meant Amazon?
I'm sorry.
Okay. I thought this was a little freaky.
Amazon and the Kindle. Yeah. No, Adobe bought Amazon. Didn't you hear?
And actually, wait. No, didn't. With the 1984 thing, you still had your notes. You still had your bookmarks. You didn't have the book that it applied to. So your notes and your bookmarks didn't.
Did you
do anything?
I thought the teenager sued them for loss of notes.
Yeah, I think that was part of the story.
Really, was it? Because I thought it was because the book wasn't there, the notes were there, but they were completely useless because they had no context. Highlighting without context.
Possible. But I don't think you could actually access the notes.
You know, that makes sense the way they store it, at least in the Kindle 3. Maybe I think it was the Kindle 2 at that point, so I'm not sure. But
we had a comment off air from Mark in Salinas. He's asked, for Gmail Plus, if you want to share with people, must all the people you want to share with be a part of Google Plus service? You can share with emailed people, but I don't know if all the content goes to the email address. I just think it says, hey, you got content on Google Plus. Ha ha.
Sorry, you can't get
it.
No,
I'm not actually sure. Do you
know? No, it seems to me it sends messages to the people who aren't on Google Plus. It sends them through email. Because it is part of the circle. So this is a user that's email only.
Right.
And
the thing is that if comments happen on that, it's not going to go to the people, right? So you can decide to email to people and when you're posting, and they get a copy of that. But in a discussion after that, they don't have access.
Yeah, exactly. It's a
decision. Then if it's a video, I don't know if they get the URL of the video, but you kind of have to make an account. I don't know, is it completely open now? Can anybody make an account?
It's still invite. For me, the invite thing is sitting down on the corner.
Yeah.
So I have to invite people, but also I've heard that some people occasionally, I'm not sure if this is true, can get in even with an invite. So.
Again, we've done like 50 listeners of GeekSpeak or 80 listeners of GeekSpeak like that. If you want to have a Gmail Plus account, please just go to our website.
Google Plus.
A Google Plus account, we'd be happy to invite you. I think if Ben and I both invite, you kind of get one. It seems like at this point, we're inviting gets one, which is kind of cool. So please feel free to send us an email on our website. Just put Google Plus in the subject line, or add me to Google Plus, whatever. It's fine. Let's go ahead and take some live calls today on the Geekest Speak. Is that okay with you guys?
Yeah,
sounds good.
All right. Mike from Santa Cruz, what's up?
Hi guys. How are you this morning?
Quite well.
Okay. Hey, there's this. I'll insult you with a simplistic question here. I have a two-wire 2400 series modem, and its range doesn't reach down to my basement. I also have an older 1000 series two-wire modem. Can I plug that in downstairs, and will that kind of just also work?
Are you talking about DSL modems?
Or, yes. Excuse me, I should have said that. Yeah.
No, a DSL modem takes up all the DSL space on your phone line. So unless you get two different services, you can't use two different modems. You could potentially
Have even both the modems on the same number.
Right, they can't work at the same time. You could potentially, if you would like, to unplug one modem and then plug the other one in. That would kind of work, but it's a little. Not gonna be very fun.
Doing that. You got any clever ideas how to do that? How to extend
second
my range?
Line.
Yeah. Well, if you're doing Wi-Fi, if that's the extension you want to do, you could do a second DSL service, but that's kind of an expensive way to do it.
Oh, sorry. All he wants is networking.
So if you want
away,
networking downstairs, it's farther away. You can actually get range extending Wi-Fi points. That's
range
one way to do it.
What do they call it?
It's
range extending Wi-Fi points.
Yeah, they're not as great as you'd hope they would be. I mean, what kind of Wi-Fi? What access point do you have right now? Do you know that it provides Wi-Fi?
I have a modem router. It's made
and
by
it has
a company,
two-wire. Okay, and it also has Wi-Fi?
It has Wi-Fi, yeah.
Yeah. So those guys are not as easy to hack into and change. But what you can do is you can get another hotspot, which is called, I'm blanking, range, what's it called? Bridge mode? But that's not what he wants to do.
Yeah, the thing is...
You could do this, simplest, but it's technically hard.
Yeah, the simplest thing would be you hook up an Apple AirPort or an AirPort Extreme, but you have to buy some extra ones. And you buy a couple of them, one right next to the two-wire, and the other one basically does acts as a repeater. It's pretty easy to set up.
Okay, and their range is greater than the two-wire 2400?
Yes. What they're doing is it's playing hopscotch. It's the first router, is just hooked up directly to the two wire, so that doesn't have to go any far, and that range will be basically the same as the two wire.
So what you're doing is you turn your two wire Wi-Fi off, and then you plug your new Wi-Fi access point into it, and then the two apples actually talk to each other, and they share network over the wireless.
Right. So if you had, let's say you had one of the modems at the 50-yard line of a football field, and then you put a second one at the 25-yard line, then the person who's at the goal line would be talking to the one at the 25-yard line, and the one at the 25-yard line would then forward that information to the one at the 50-yard line.
Now, that would take two of those AirPort reports.
Yeah, and the reason we're suggesting this way is there's actually a way to do it from the two-wire Wi-Fi access point, but there's no, like, real clean standard. So normally when you're doing bridged shared network stuff, you kind of want the same unit to do this. Like, I've set up around my house where I've got some Apple products and I've got some Linksys products, and I put a new BIOS on the Linksys products. Actually, Miles put a new BIOS on the Linksys products. But that whole process is extremely complicated. Anytime there's a problem, I got to put in my geek brain and fix it, right? So when you do one hardware manufacturer and they do the bridging, then it just kind of works. Now, okay, the other way to do this...
It just has a greater range than the...
I wouldn't say it has a greater range. It's much more that you get to put a second one at the outskirts of its range, and then the new range is the new range from another point, right? So you get two spots.
Okay.
Now,
one other solution
I've got for you... One other idea I've got for you is that if you could run a cable down to your basement and just buy one access point, you could run an Ethernet cable from your two-wire modem, plug it in the back like you would a computer, then run that cable all the way downstairs and then get a hotspot. You'd actually have two networks in your home. And as long as you put them on different channels, which they would probably automatically do, you'd be totally set. So that's
What would I need at the end of that cable? You said the hotspot.
An RJ45, the hotspot, any kind of hub, any wireless hub is what they're called, or a wireless router.
Okay, I see. So that would, that might be a way to do it.
I would do it that way, and then you've got to get a long Cat5 cable, and you got to run it down to your basement.
Cat6. Appreciate your help, gents.
Thank you so much, Mike.
Yeah. Bye.
If you'd like to call in with questions or comments about technology, the phone numbers are 1-800-655-5877.
And just to round out that call, there is also the possibility of getting something that's a dedicated range extender. That's probably a little bit cheaper than the Apple Express route, except that I'm going from like the easiest to the most difficult. The Apple one, I think, is probably the easiest.
Yeah.
The buying another third-party range extender and trying to work that out is going to be the next hardest. And then if you're really wanting to, dig into it, if you really are a geek, then you buy, for example, an old Linksys router and you put DDWRT or Tomato or something like that on it and you use that as a range extender.
And that's actually a Linux distribution that's four Wi-Fi access points. The other thing you can do is sometimes these things actually do communicate, like the two wire might have the correct stuff to do a network that way.
Yeah.
I just don't know what the BIOS looks like.
Cheap, easy. Choose one.
Yeah. Doing the Tomato thing, though, is pretty – doing your own BIOS on the old Linksys boxes are pretty awesome.
Yes, but this is Geek Speak, so we know we have that audience out there that's curious about
that's
it.
The way to and, do it. And the other, the company that's producing really great antennas, which you could actually buy one antenna and spread it throughout the room, I can't remember the name of, and it's been kicking me. I'll try to put it up on the website when I think of it. They've got some really, $100 antenna Wi-Fi access points that go a long ways that are really nice.
Yeah, I also got a bunch of old Linksys routers, or Drafton anyway, but they're not 5 gigahertz, they're only 2.4 gigahertz. But they're used, and they were $35 used, and so I bought a bunch of them. And that's a really great way of just having this daisy chain going out there.
What's it called when you do it that way?
There are a couple ways of doing it, actually, but the way that I was doing it was wireless distribution system.
Yeah.
And that's the standard that Apple uses as well.
WDS, yeah. All right, let's go on to the next call. From Watsonville, Robert, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Thank you. In regard to your last caller, you can go to Gray Bears, and they have tons of wireless routers, Apple Airports, Linksys, two wires, $10 a piece. That's a good place to pick them up.
Where is this?
Gray Bears in Santa Cruz on Chancellor.
Nice. Good. I like Gray Bears.
They got a lot of computer stuff cheap there if you're looking for older stuff to rehab your gear. So,
all right. Good. Robert gets a little bit of money from Gray Bears. Nice.
Okay. So,
what's the question?
So my question, guys, I have an Apple Quicksilver running 10.4 with my iTunes library. I bought a new iPod, and I bought a new iMac, and I was thinking I could use my iPod to download my songs and take it to my iMac, my new iMac, but they it uploaded the library, but it didn't load it in the playlist and stuff like that. And I've called Apple support, and they've given me three or four attempts of answers that don't work.
Okay, so first off, does your older Mac have FireWire port?
Yes, it does.
Okay, so the iPod's great and it's wonderful, but stop using that for your transportation. Mm-hmm. There's a really wonderful way to connect Macintosh together. You shut down your older, you get them in the same room together, and you get a FireWire cable that goes between the two. And for your new iMac, you have to have an 800 FireWire 800.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming.
And for your old one, need a 400.
Does the new iMac have FireWire? Yeah, all of them do. Yeah. And the old one, you need a 400. And you're going to shut down your old Macintosh. And when you start it up again, hold the T down, as in Troxel, down on the keyboard, and it's actually for target mode. And after a while, there'll be a symbol on your computer that will be a FireWire symbol. You plug those two computers together, and then the old computer looks like a hard drive for your new computer. Then you run this thing called Migration Assistant, which is inside utilities, and you
Hold on a second. Old computer looks like a hard drive?
Yeah, it'll show up as a hard drive on your new computer. And okay. Once you've done this, then on your new computer, you run Migration Assistant, and you say, get the data off the old thing, and it will move over. The other thing you could manually do, you could go find your iTunes library and just copy your iTunes library folder over. Keep in mind that GeekSpeak is recorded. We get the podcast up later, and you're welcome to listen to what I just said over and over again if you'd like. Thank you so much for the call, Robert.
One real quick question.
Yeah.
The new iMac does 800 FireWire. I don't think it does. And the old iMac only has 400 FireWire.
Yeah. So there's 400 to 800 cables. Anytime you plug a slower device into a faster FireWire, the faster FireWire will slow down to work with the older. They're backwards compatible. The hardware is different, but the 800 to 400 cable is it's a common cable to get. So you're looking for FireWire 400 to FireWire 800.
Okay, so then one last thing on this. Okay. I got a minute?
Yeah.
There are some new songs on the new iMac. Is it going to erase that in the library?
No, I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know with Migration Assistant either, but
I don't think it will. I think Migration Assistant's not the best way to do it. I think the library is the best way to do it. Because if you move the library over...
But then you lose your playlist.
Do you have a lot
and
of
your ratings.
You might lose your new playlists and your ratings.
Here's what I would recommend. Back up your new computer's iTunes folder, the entire music iTunes folder. Back that up if you have enough space.
Where is that held?
That's held in your users folder. So if you just click on the Finder, it'll open up a new Finder window, and it'll be right there. Double click on music, it's right there. Yeah. Okay. And a couple other quick points. I think just typically it's a good idea when you're doing target disk mode, don't plug it in until after you shut down the old machine. Right? Don't plug in the FireWire cable before you do all of that.
Shut down both. Hook them up, then
exactly.
The old one. Okay,
yeah. What's really important is that before you plug them together, to have the old machine in target mode.
Yeah,
it's actually not really a problem with Apple hardware because they've always compensated for
it's an older machine though.
DC voltage differentiation, but it's a safer way to go. Let's go on. Thank you, Robert, very much for the call.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. You know, it's funny. The 400, 800 cable. He's going to buy that cable.
Oh.
And he's going to have it forever.
Here's the other thing. If it's a monster cable and it costs like $100 bajillion, don't buy that.
Yeah. That cable should be under $10.
Buy the cheapest one you can find,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
Because the cheapest brand you can find is just as good as the monster cable,
right.
Even though
the
it's not.
The only reason more expensive cables are good in the FireWire situation is that they might have longer durability. But you don't care because you're going to use it once. The other thing is borrow it from a friend.
Only strain relief. I mean,
just borrow it from a friend. I mean, if you can. That's the thing.
Digital signals, it just works or it doesn't work. There's no quality.
I'm just talking about stress release.
Sure.
From Marina, Samantha, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi.
Hi.
So I have an older Mac. It's a G4 laptop.
Okay.
And it won't update any higher than 10.4.11.
Mm-hmm.
But what's really odd is I thought there was a problem with our wireless for a while, but it turns out it's just that Safari and the Apple updater won't work. They don't see the connection, but I've got a really good, strong airport connection to our wireless, and Mozilla does work.
Mm. Perfect. Just use Mozilla. It's
Firefox.
Well, yeah, except that the Apple updater won't work either.
Yeah.
And that's,
it's possible. That's a very strange case that shouldn't be happening. It's possible that for some reason you're set up to use a proxy. And that proxy's down now, and that's why Safari's not working. So I would go to System Preferences, then Network, and then for the location, there's a drop-down for location. Just create a new one. And
create a new proxy?
No, create a new location in your network's system. Just use that drop-down and say create new, and then see if it works from there. You have to apply that.
Okay, so System and Network?
System Preferences, then Network, then create a new location. And the reason I'm saying create a new location is you could mess with your current thing, but since it works partially, you want to keep it there. So you create a new one, and its default settings
should work. When I open up Network, I just keep getting this pop-up that says your network settings have changed by another application, and it's a loop, and I can't...
Yeah, this happens.
Cancel,
I've seen this before. Yeah. No, you can't get out of it. You got to delete those system preferences for network. But then you might have some trouble getting it hooked back up.
Well,
so inside. Yeah, Ben,
I can just tell you, and then you can listen to the show one more time just to get to it. But click on the Finder. If it doesn't open up your user folder, press Command N to get to that. Go into Libraries. Go into Preferences. And then there's com.apple.system preferences, and delete that one.
Don't delete it. Move it to your desktop.
I'm sorry. Rename it or
copy it
somewhere and then delete it so you have it. But if you reset that, you should be fine. It's gonna just reset your network your network preferences to something that's
normal. Keep in mind,
it
kind of works right now. That might be the right way to do it.
yeah.
I'll just rename it and have it in case.
That's right. In case you want to revert.
Yeah.
Good luck.
Perfect. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Oh, is that all you have to do? Usually I'm very bullish about Apple products and going, oh, they're so easy. That's one case where not so much.
Well, that definitely has an error. You know, there's definitely
there's something
It's possible the hard drive's bad, right? And the file's actually having a hard time writing. There's a lot
it
of things.
It could be
that
a
could
million
be
things.
Yeah.
It could be a million things.
I'm nervous that person's going to have a hard time. Keep in mind, please, Samantha, your computer is kind of working right now. Don't change anything. No, you should. Should we take one more call, or should we go ahead and take one more news story? We got 4 minutes. Jay here in Santa Cruz is saying, take a call.
Something just crossed my mind. That might work. That might not reset your network.
Yeah.
It might be somewhere else.
You might need to do the network preference file instead, which is also going to be com.apple.something. That's network preference.
It doesn't have network
Samantha,
in the name.
Samantha, if you're still listening, call us again. We'll maybe help after the show. Jay from Santa Cruz, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hey, thank you. I just had a quick question. I know you guys weren't going to do Lion questions today, but I've been using Quicken for years. And, of course, Quicken uses Rosetta, and this is this whole horrible conundrum. And Quicken Essentials is kind of lame and a joke. And so I'm just wondering if you guys have any suggestions on, you know, has anybody done anything that
Have you heard of Quicken Essentials? Just kidding.
Yeah.
And that's always the response people have, and it's like, no, that won't work. And I totally get that. Ben, do you have any suggestions?
Yeah, Quicken Essentials will work. Have you heard of it? No. Quicken 2005, 2006, 2007 all will not work. It's on the Intuit website, unfortunately. So I don't think there's really anything for it.
Don't go to Lion.
Yeah.
Just don't go to Lion. Yeah.
That's why I'm going to wait at least 6 months.
The other question is, has anybody ever tried iBank or Moneywell or any of these?
I use Moneywell.
Yeah,
it's not Quicken. You know, I mean, the thing is, when you get used to Quicken, it's an application that's essential to your computing. Like, you can't really get rid of it. And I've had these discussions about, well, Moneywell's a great app. It's, you know, I like it a lot. It's a different kind of flavor than Quicken. It does syncing well. It does, you know, I can get my transactions from my bank, from my credit cards, no problem. I can get them synced in and see them. And it's great in all those respects, but it's not Quicken. It's going to be different. You're going to change your workflow. What I would do is go ahead and try the Moneywell, see how it goes. It'll import your Quicken data in, and then see if you like it. I think they have a 30-day trial, and then see if you like it. And if you like it, you could switch over to it and then move to Lion later on, and you'll be okay. But I'm just surprised Intuit's not providing a Quicken. Their solution is, well, do it online. Do all your transactional banking and all your accounting online. What could possibly go wrong?
Well, it's even worse than that. I mean, basically what they said was you know, go to Quicken Essentials or go to Mint, which is, you know, online. But if you have investments, move to Quicken for Windows and run Parallels or VMware. You know, that's their solution.
I hear what they're saying. I think that is the solution, unfortunately. Silly. I think Intuit's doing the wrong thing. And I've got to go. Thank you so much for calling in.
Thank you.
I also use Mint, and I think it's a lot of fun, but I don't rely on it. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KSP. We're streaming and podcasting at ksp.org. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of online tech with David Lawrence, and he's used with permission. Everything we talk about is available at geekspeak.org. The Geeks Today, Miles Elam, Ben Jaffe, I'm Lyle Troxell. Hey, and we'll see you next week.